Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Welcome to episode 46 of the Lean 911 podcast. Mark DeLuzio here with a colleague and a friend of mine who I've known for quite a while, Nathan Corliss. We're going to talk today about respect for people. Nathan, you and I have had a lot of conversations about this topic. And also, we've interfaced on LinkedIn quite a bit about this topic and weighed in. And I just thought you had a lot of interesting things to say about this respect for people, which is, you know, if you Google the respect for people on LinkedIn, if there's such a thing you could do, you get 5 million posts on this RFP thing, right? And everybody has their view on it as to what it is and all that. But I thought some of your comments were pretty interesting on this. And I thought I'd have you on the show to kind of talk about that. Your background, you have a continuous improvement background, a very good background. You work for Danaher. You are now with Grunt Company in a continuous improvement space. And if anybody wants to disagree with you and mess with you, you're a martial arts expert. So I just want to let people know that you it comes with your peril if you want to disagree with Nathan, but no, I'm only kidding. And but we've been colleagues and friends for a while, and welcome to the show, Nathan.
Yeah, no, Mark, thank you very much for the invite. It's an honor to be on this show. We followed each other for a long time, followed your work, of course, you know, first learning through the Danaher Business System. A little bit of my background. I started as a machinist when I was 19 years old, almost 30 years ago, and then grew into operational roles, quality management, and with the quality management always came the continuous improvement. Had a little bit of a stint in healthcare, you know, took a break from manufacturing, worked in the healthcare industry, and a lot of interesting stories there. And then came back to the Gund Company, where I'm currently the director of quality and continuous improvement. And yes, 100%, you know, we've had these conversations. It's a popular topic, seems like post-COVID, about respect for people. And happy to just be on this show and contribute and get to have this dialogue.
Well, you know, one of the other reasons I think you're a good host, a good guest in this case, is that coming out of a manufacturing operator type of environment where you worked your way up through with all your degrees and into management, you got to see the full spectrum. A lot of people who come into these leadership roles get put there without ever having to know even which end to hold the broom. Okay. So you saw from a lot of different perspectives on your way up the ladder in terms of where you are today, starting from your initial job at 19 years old. And so I think that also gives you a different look at this this topic as well. Let's just start with a very academic question. What's respect for people to you?
Oh, wow. You could go on forever. I mean, respect for people to me, it's not necessarily just being nice, but are you taking mm-hmm. their thoughts in consideration? I always had the belief that, I mean, humans have been problem solving for ever since humans have been around, and they know how to problem solve. They've been doing it. And sometimes in the lean and continuous improvement world, we put together these structures and processes and tools. And if they're not formally trained in it or experienced it, they sometimes get hung up on that. Like, this is complex. I don't understand DMAIC. I don't understand PDCA. And where my approach, and thanks for calling me a martial arts expert. I'm definitely not an expert, but I have some training. I always say, in all of this, I know enough to be dangerous. That's about it. But what I have found is if you strip away the formality and you focus on the principles and you make it relatable to the people doing the work, it'll have more impact. A couple just examples myself, you know, when I was my first Danaher role and I was a Danaher Business System leader, and I go through the training and I had my sensei with me at the facility and we're talking about a problem. And he said, oh, we're going to go to Gemba. We're going to do a value stream mapping session, and we're going to poke yoke the process and ensure all of these things. And but when he presented that to the people on the shop floor, they're all like, what did he say? And I replied with, we're going to go out and we're going to look at the process, we're going to draw it out, and then we're going to find ways to make this more error proof so that we don't repeat our mistakes. Oh, well, why don't you just say that? We don't know this lingo you're talking about. And then when I transitioned to healthcare, I was working with nurses and doctors. They're not used to a lot of the Japanese terminology that we use in lean and continuous improvement today. They speak healthcare. So I thought it was my job to adapt to them. They don't have to adapt to me. I should adapt to them. And I had to adopt and learn their language so that it connected and resonated. And the very first time I was doing a training session, and I have my slide up there, and I have DMAIC and PDCA and Genshi Genbutsu and Gemba, all these key buzzwords on a slide. And I raise my hand, ask the doctors to raise their hand. Who here knows and understands what you're doing? And these are some highly educated, very academic physicians and surgeons and nurses that are much smarter than I'll ever be. Like barely a few people raised their hand. I said, I bet you know this and you already do it well. You probably do it better than me because you're doing it in a crisis situation. I go, just think about how you treat a patient. You go to a patient, they have some symptoms of something wrong. So you evaluate those symptoms, which you're kind of doing a root cause analysis. Then you establish, might have to even establish some stability and get it stable. Then you put a treatment plan in place. Then you put the treatment plan in place, and then you check to see if it's working. If not, you readjust the plan. Yeah, we do that all the time. Okay, you know how to do this, but instead of do it to a patient, take that same principle and apply it to a process. Oh, we've never heard it explained to us that way. So I feel as a CI practitioner that we need to connect with the individuals and respect what they already do well. And know that they probably have knowledge and they can do it and do it really well and connect it to what they do well and just then apply it with our frameworks. And I think sometimes that's a missing gap between CI practitioners and their formality and structure, and they make progress. And it became very apparent. So during COVID, I moved into more of an emergency management role. We had to get the campus ready for the COVID surges. And that's also a very fast environment. And if you try to use that terminology in an environment where there's a little bit of crisis going on and people are nervous and scared, it shut them off. You had to strip away all the formality. In my head, I'm going through the DMAIC process and PDCA process, but I didn't have them fill out a formal tool or a form. We're just on a whiteboard and we're just filling it out or on a napkin, but we're following the principles. And especially in that environment, which you had to respond quickly and be conscientious of this emotional, unsure environment is what we had to do to make things work. And I think for me, respect for people again goes back to respecting what they already know, connecting these principles of lean and continuous improvement to what they already do so that they can maybe understand that framework a little bit better. Go, oh, I can do this. You're already doing it. You can do it. I'm just here to help and advocate for them.
Well, it's really interesting you say that because I have had a lot of dialogue over the years and of late where there's an incredible amount of criticism of leadership. And hey, look, some is deserved, okay? But I think you made the comment when you and I were talking offline, you never see any criticism from a leader about their employees or, their subordinates or whatever, which is interesting because I know, having managed hundreds of people over the course of my career, not everybody's a good apple. Okay. You have sometimes as much tyranny in the employee ranks as you do in the leadership ranks. It's not isolated to one demographic. You got the bell curve everywhere. And I sometimes think, of a leader who has 10 of these people, these people who think they could do their job better, working for them, and these people only have one leader, right, to worry about. So what I'm getting to the point there, what you brought up earlier that you and I talked about, and you gave in this example, do we really put ourselves in the seat of our clients, of our customers, of our leadership? Do we really even understand what a CEO's job is? Do we really, how many people have written a job description for a CEO? I have, okay? And let me tell you, it's not what people think it is. Matter of fact, it's an awful job, believe it or not. It really is, if you think about what it is. And at least I think it's an awful job, okay? I wouldn't want it. So when you look at, are we really sitting down and understanding where they're coming from? How do they get paid? How do they get measured? If you're not talking in some sense their language, they're going to tune you out. Not everybody is looking for global wonderfulness and touchy-feely stuff. Some people are saying, "Hey, I gotta make my numbers. And if I don't make my numbers, I'm gone." Okay. And we don't have an appreciation for that. Sometimes we have a disdain for making money, for example. And so you brought that out in your example. And is that something that you've seen quite a bit throughout your career? Just CI people in general, just not getting understanding, A, what their job is, B, who their customer is, and what that person's going through as well.
Yeah, as CI practitioners, we always say we need to listen to people and make sure everyone's feedback is provided. And I still 100% believe that your best consultants, you say this all the time, are the people that are doing the work. And I'm going to listen to them and advocate for them and make processes as efficient and to, because they're the ones doing the work. And I'm going to ask for their ideas on how to do it. But we also should take that same, if we're going to say we listen to them, we also need to listen to every stakeholder. What are the directors? What are the CEOs? What is the presidents? What are they after? Because oftentimes they're the ones with the more larger view of the organization, the environment, what they're planning towards that not necessarily is communicated down. So, I mean, a good strategic planning session and a plan we'll have alignment through the whole organization. And if we go off and we're working on some good things, but it's not necessarily aligned to necessarily the organization's development and the strategy where they're going, you might be spending resources that could be better used elsewhere. But so the respect for people is one, listening to everybody, and that's hard, especially in big organizations. So how do you have that in your processes and structures? And then how do you have that alignment so that you're not, if I go off as a CI practitioner and I'm working with an operator, a facility on a process, and I don't share or know that there's a bigger potential change coming, they're just going to get frustrated because you're going to change it up on them anyway. It's okay to say, hey, there are bigger things coming. Let's pause on this. But as long as you explain the why, that's respect. Kind of going back to leadership too. Toby, don't you like you say we don't hear about, like you just said, challenging employees. It's usually criticism of leaders. And as a leader, I believe that if I have a challenging employee, it's still on me as a leader. What am I got to be introspective and reflect on what am I doing? What can I change in my process? I still take accountability for that. And you had mentioned about being on the right seat, and one of my favorite books, Good to Great by Jim Collins, says, respect for people is also maybe did we put people in the role that they weren't necessarily suited for? You want them on the bus, but maybe they just need to be on a different seat of the bus to best utilize their talents. And maybe putting someone in a role that they're not capable or they're not set up for. Is that really respect to both the organization, their peers, and that individual? If someone says, hey, you're
All
going
the
to
way
become,
around, all the way around.
right. If someone says, hey, Nathan, we're going to put you into sales, Oh my goodness. I am not a good salesperson. I would need a lot of development and training. It's going to be more of a hindrance to organization than where I'm better suited in the roles that I'm in. So finding that right sweet
I think
spot.
you'd be good in sales, but I think your point, you have to feel comfortable in that role. You have to, if it's not part of your DNA, let's say you're an introvert and you got to go out and talk to customers all the time. Well, that's not going to work, right? But one of the other things too I've noticed is, and now okay, now I'm going to kind of go back on criticizing leadership. I've seen many companies who want to start, a lean initiative. And what they're really enamored with is the potential results that they can get, not necessarily the journey of doing Kaizen, of bringing in somebody like yourself who's experienced and good at what you do. And they don't want to change their mindset, but they say, I got to get my people to change. And my first question when I hear that of a leader is, how about yourself? What are you going to do? Because what you've done to get to the position you're at, we're pretty much a traditional path. And now we're saying, well, look, you want to take it to the next level. The traditional stuff that you've done and the thinking isn't going to make it. You've got to change that thinking before you ask your people to change. I always say, did you make your bed today? But one of the biggest disrespects I have, and I appreciate your comments on this, is, and you kind of alluded to it to a degree, leaders who say, hey, we started a lean, initiative. We put all the posters up and bought all the right t-shirts and all that, but did not provide the framework to do Kaizen, did not provide the framework to do problem solving as you described. But they still expect it. And one of the posters on the wall would say, we believe our employees are our best consultants and we solve problems at the lowest possible level. I'll go back and tell you a quick story. So at Jake Break, when this all started at Danaher, and I was there and I took over the Asian business and I had Hino Motors as a client, as a customer. Hino's the heavy duty truck company for Toyota. So I got a good influx of them as a customer. And I was over in Japan one day. Now, we had put in a Jacobs improvement system, which really our suggestion system, okay? And we were tracking with a UOW workforce 2 suggestions per month per employee, okay? So I go over to Hino Motors and I'm on their shop floor and I see this chart. And I asked what the chart was and it says, that's our suggestions per employee. But they were tracking at 9 per month per employee. 9. And as I probed further, they weren't just suggestions, they were implemented suggestions. Okay. Ours would have been, you put one in that says paint the building pink. We counted it. Okay. We got employee engagement. Okay. Well, those were implemented. So I said, well, how'd you get 9 implemented per employee per month? They took the time out of the tack time calculation of available time on Friday afternoon. They provided their employees the time, the resources. You need tool room, you need maintenance, you need IT, whatever it is, engineering, and the training and the process in which to solve problems. Okay. So now you look at it, they provided the framework to be successful. I don't know how many companies I know that say they're doing lean. And they don't do any Kaizen, okay? But they still expect the results that they read about of what, a Danaher gets or some of the things that and it's like, how's that gonna work? Through osmosis by the posters that you put up or the t-shirt that you made me wear? It's not gonna work. To me, that is a huge disrespect. I mean, how many times have you seen that?
I've seen that a fair amount in organizations I've even gone to that wanted to do, say, a business turnaround. Oh, we want a lean program. I go, this takes time because to do it right, it needs to be ingrained in your culture, and cultural shifts take a long time. And it still goes back down to, are you engaging your people to help them solve their own problems? I've often seen in organizations where they have dedicated lean practitioners, and that's all they do, but they end up just becoming project managers and scribes,
Yeah.
and they'll just go on and say, this is what you have to go do and go do, and not even engage the people doing the work.
Don't forget, hey, by the way, don't forget the PowerPoint.
I do like my PowerPoints. I can't deny that, but it goes back. My philosophy was just went back to that when I was a machine operator, and they hired a consultant. It was to do ISO certification, and but it was also how to improve business processes. And so I'm running my machine, and this individual comes, doesn't talk to me, doesn't ask me questions, says, "Your cell's set up wrong." What do you mean? You're supposed to be a U-shaped cell in a counterclockwise position. What? And then he left. Now, working in a shop, sometimes we use different colorful language. I said some words that aren't HR friendly that I won't repeat here. But if he would have asked me to go, I'm left-handed. So ergonomically, the flow that I had was worked for me, but we could easily change it over to the next operator, just move things around really quickly because we had it on conversion. So he would be set up too. So we didn't have to inconvenience anyone. But he said, I did it wrong. And I always said, if I ever become a consultant, I don't want to become a consultant, but if I ever become one, I'm not going to be that guy. I'm going to ask questions. And that just should be the approach. And like I said, yeah, the slogans, I call that the dog and pony show. You can do all sorts of pretty things, but if it's really cultural, like it gets to the part where your people are automatically solving their problems and doing it themselves. And one of the most satisfying things for me, and it took a while to get there, when I would work with a year, I would be assigned a nursing unit to support. And again, it goes back to respect for people of my approach was, I'm not an expert here. You are the experts here. You need to show me what you guys are doing. I don't know anything about treating a patient. I don't know about, dealing with this stuff. So I'm just going to be your advocate. You tell me what you want to change to make your life easier. Here's a few principles and concepts. And how can I help and advocate for you? Then we start brainstorming. It was really building relationships. Like 95% of my job is relationships, 3% knowing which tool to pull out and when. We'll get back to that. And then 2% just try something and fake it till you make it, but then just try it. It didn't work. Try something else and just keep trying. And I would go and take their suggestions and we put together a nice plan and say, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to approach. Oh, that's brilliant. You really solved problems for us. I didn't solve this problem. I just, Gina in that nursing unit is the one that actually came up with this idea. We're just going to try her idea. And then over time, it was I'd go and visit them and they would start asking me questions on, hey, how do you think we should approach this? I have this idea here. That's a good idea. Go try it. Maybe watch out for this, but go try it. And then it got to become more and more. I'd walk in the unit, they say, hey, look at all the stuff that we've changed ourselves. That's great. Like, I thought my job as a lean practitioner was to work my way out of a job so that they're solving problems for themselves. Like, that to me is the ultimate respect. One, respecting that they already know how to solve the problem, just maybe give them a few little bit of guidance along the way, or have to advocate for them to who's making decisions. And then I have to make the connection to the leaders of here's how it's going to connect to your strategy and what you're trying to achieve. And to me, that's how a lean culture is developed, and it takes time. And then you build in the structures and process kind of afterwards. Because if you start with tools, I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? But if you teach them principles first and what they're trying to achieve and connect it to their work, then you can add structure on top of it over time. Because I'm in it for the long haul. And then it's okay if they're not using a tool perfectly, but are they making the intentional improvements in that area? In my opinion, is the way to
You're right on the
approach it.
money. You're right on the money with the principles. I mean, so many people want to start with the tools, and then when the tools don't fit their situation, they say, "Oh, this doesn't work. We don't make cars," you know. And But you're absolutely right about the principle. So one of the people would ask me at Danaher, what was Danaher's culture? I don't know. You tell me. I mean, what facility do you want to go to? And I'll tell you about their culture, maybe. And they were all different. But the one thing that held us together were the principles. So if you want to call that a culture aspect, yeah, okay. Because that's how we try to behave towards those principles. We weren't always successful. Just because we said this was a principle didn't mean we always were religious about adhering to it. And that's a discipline issue. I guess you can argue discipline is a culture, or lack thereof. But question I have for you is, by the way, at Danaher, you worked at Danaher after I left.
Right.
I did not allow left-handed people to be hired at Danaher, just to let you know. Okay, so you're lucky I wasn't there. Okay, anyway, but
Hey, we're the only people in our right mind.
okay, that's a good one. You practiced that one, didn't you? Okay, so my question to you is, you started out as a machine operator at 19. Can you recall what your view of leadership was at that point in time? You're a young kid, got this job, you're working as a machine operator. I don't know if you had aspirations someday to be in them someday, or what, but what was your view of leadership when you were in there at 19 years old?
Oh man, if I go back, probably a mix. Because I was gracious to that. I got into manufacturing, so I needed a job with medical insurance. My dad had retired when I graduated high school, so I needed a full-time job. And I just had a friend that worked at this company, Carling Manufacturing, and the owner, his name was Earl Walker, eccentric kind of individual. But he generally cared about people. And he would give people a chance. And if he saw that you worked, he'd give you opportunity. I was running a pin straightener. We would make these ball lock pins. Carling makes tooling, fixturing, and jigs. And my first job was, I'm running this pin straightener. And he comes by one day and he looks around and he says, "Where's all your work?" I go, "I finished it." "What do you mean you finished it?" "I stayed here and I did the work." "Huh." And he leaves. Comes back a week later, "I'm going to put you in the CNC department." "All right." He goes, "You stayed busy and you just kept busy." And I go, "Isn't that what you pay me to do?" "Okay, I'm going to put you in the CNC department." I get in the department, like, "I don't know anything about operating. I don't know anything about machining. So I'm going to send you to Rankin Technical College. It's a technical school here in St. Louis. It's accredited, very, really good program." He sent me to school, and then we had a programmer that left. And I said, went up to him and I go, "Hey, you just paid for me to go to school for programming. Let me do it. Can you do it? We'll find out. You just paid for me to go to school. Might as well use it." So he's like, "All right, you got the chance, kid." So he gave me opportunities, so I never looked bad on leadership. I might not agree on everything. He and I actually argued in the shop one day. He wanted me to put a shelf together with our heavy fixtures on the very top shelf. I go, "No, that's dumb because I have to reach up and have this 40-pound fixture over my head. I'm doing this." And he's like, "You do what I tell you to do." I go, "Not what if it's not safe. I'm not doing it." And so we'd argue in the shop floor, and I go, "Oh man, he's gonna fire me." So I'm just some dumb 20-year-old kid at the time. I came down and said, "Well, you're right, but you shouldn't argue with me." I go, "Well, if it deals with mine and my team's safety, I'm going to argue with you." "Yeah, you know what? You're right." So I never really looked negatively on leadership, because again, I'm getting paid to do a job.
You had a good mentor there. That was super. Now, let me ask you, would you have gone to school if it wasn't for him?
Probably not.
Yeah. Isn't
Probably not.
that amazing?
At the time, he just said, "I'm sending you here." He didn't ask me if I wanted to go.
Wow.
He said, "I'm sending you here." I said, "Okay."
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because sometimes God puts people in your life for a reason. It's amazing. But well, let me turn this over to something that you and I were talking about a couple of weeks ago, on LinkedIn. There was a cartoon, And it was these three or four people standing around in a conference room in a Gemba board type of meeting where they're looking at graphs and charts and all that stuff. And somebody's walking in late to the meeting. And one of the people in the group of three or four, I think, says something to the effect, "Do we have to start over?" And that was the post. And so everybody started weighing in with their comments about how disrespectful this individual was to come in late to the meeting, blah, 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 right? But you had a different take on that, on that post, on that cartoon, if you will. Why don't you tell us about your thought process when you saw that and what went through your mind?
It's at the highest level, yes. If somebody's walking in late because they stopped at Starbucks, they wanted to get a coffee, and they're already running behind, that individual didn't show respect. But I think the most important thing is to understand, why were they late? There could be many different reasons. You've shared the example of, what if they got a phone call and found out someone was sick? Or, I was in healthcare. If a nurse was late to the stand-up huddle meeting because they were treating a patient that was coding, the right thing to do is to take care of the patient. And I'm sure not going to criticize them for doing what's right by taking care of the patient first. That's what's most
You
important
mean to
here.
tell me that the nurse didn't have the professionalism to tell the patient to hold on with their heart attack while they attended the Gemba board? I don't understand that at all, Nathan. I mean,
Right.
I think your priorities screwed
Yeah. And then for
up.
me, yeah, right. Yeah, well, sorry, you just got to hold. We'll come back to your heart attack later. As a people leader, I feel I have an obligation to take care of our team members. I'm walking through a facility and I see a potential unsafe condition. I need to address that unsafe condition first before going to this huddle meeting. Or if a customer calls and like, hey, we had an issue, our line is down, can you help us get some parts fast? Well, give me about 30 minutes. I gotta go to my huddle meeting first. I'll call you back. No, I want to take care of the customer first. But that being said, those huddle meetings are usually driven with visual management boards. So, regardless, because people are on different shifts, they're taking care of patients, taking care of customers, a visual management board shouldn't need someone standing there to explain the condition of the work, the actions that might be taken, or to know what I need to go mitigate. That's what visual management is for. I can look at it within 3 to 5 seconds and understand what I need to go do. So, make sure your structure is designed in a way that you don't have to have perfect attendance, because that's not respect for the people that have to go take care of customers, patients on a different shift, stop because there was an accident. And that's the whole point of that tool, is that people can look at it and know what they have to go do without having to have as much interaction, or go do follow up on your own. And that's how I always respond with that. And some people still focus on, oh no, being late is disrespectful, but we need to understand the whys. And to me, you have to have the guide rails of safety, quality, delivery. That was ingrained in me for my days at Danaher. And if I have to take care of a safety issue first, I'm going to do that first. If I take care of a quality issue first, I'm going to do that first. If there's an issue with someone called in, sick, and they need to finish packing this thing, I'll go pack that so it gets shipped out to the customer on time. Because the outcome of those huddle meetings, like, what's the really and true intended outcome? It's just understand work and help minimize the firefighting, and to use that to have visibility so everyone knows the status of work by visual management, in my mind. Do you have to be for a meeting for that, or just have to have a good visual management board?
Now, that's a very interesting perspective on that, because if you are doing your visuals right, you don't need have to have somebody stand there and read the numbers to you in a huddle meeting, which most of those meetings are. You look up at the board. Yeah, our plan was 180. We hit 170 because we had a problem with, well, that should be on there too. Okay. But more likely, those are lagging indicators. What are you going to do about it? What are the leading indicators as to why you missed? It's interesting that you looked at it that way, because that particular post on LinkedIn, almost everybody with exception, you being one, me being the other, and maybe a couple others, but persecuted the person walking in late. The other thing that was missing out of context in that is this person pretty much always on time, or are they habitual, because I have seen that where companies are habitually late, or they'll pick up a phone right in the middle of a conversation and start talking, or they'll be on their computer during a presentation. And I always said the little things mean a lot, because that means they're just kind of like indicators of some bigger transgressions that are going on. Now, if this person, and we didn't know based on that cartoon, we didn't know that if, that person was a pretty good attender to this meeting, but just so happens that data had a problem. And now we're gonna shame that person, right? We're gonna shame that person in front of the group and say, hey, why are you late? So I don't know. I just think your perspective on that was interesting in that regard. Nathan, this is good. You have a good handle on this and on the people side. And I think that's admirable, which is one of the reasons I wanted you on the show. Any other thoughts before we close this out?
The other thing about respect for people, and I've seen this before, it's making the process of continuous improvement as easy as possible for those who want to improve. And I've often seen where they're either an internal or external consultant, well, you have to follow every tool that's in our toolbox because that's what our process is set up. And I am very one, I built my lean career off of being lazy. I don't like doing extra work. I was a machine operator and I asked the question, why am I walking so far from my tools? Can I just make my tools? I didn't know what that was called. I just didn't want to walk so far. And I also go by the philosophy of, and some people don't like this, every situation dictates your response. It all depends on the situation you're in. And, wait a minute, why do I have to fill out this tool? This problem doesn't require this tool. We can just go do it right now. It's going to spend more time filling out this tool than it is to actually just go fix the
You
problem.
become a slave to the process.
And organization I used to work at, their internal consultants were measured on their engagement hours, their billable hours. Oh, I can spend 5 hours doing this particular engagement and use all these different tools, and I'm getting closer to my metric. And I wasn't measured by that. I go, we can do this in an hour because I got other things I can go work on. But that wasn't was my metric. But people will respond to how they're being measured. And the other thing from like respect for people, for me, it's just like we talked about, you have to learn to adjust to the individual. And this really resonated when in my martial arts self-defense career, when I started becoming teaching this and recognizing that, and we talk about this, you can't copy Toyota, you can't copy Danaher.
No.
Because you're not Danaher, you're not Toyota. But you can learn and learn the principles of what they did and make it work for you. Well, when I started teaching self-defense with my partner, Jesse, we often work with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And my partner, Jesse, is 100 pounds smaller than I am. If I say she has to do what I'm comfortable with, she could get hurt. What works for me doesn't work for everyone else. It's just what works
Interesting.
for me. And honestly, what worked one time might not work all the time. So you can't copy individuals. But if you understand those principles of body movement and structure, how to generate force, then you could use these tools to work what's best for you in a self-defense world. Even if you're chronically injured, you have certain circumstances. What is a principle that you could apply for you? And I found when I was doing that and started engaging other individuals, it was, yeah, this worked when I was at this company here, or I went to this other company and we made it work, but it might not work for here. So let's tweak it and change it and make it work for us. And I think that's the right philosophy because
And
it
it might
helps
not
that, again,
work.
that's respect for people.
Yeah, and it might not work even for the culture, you know.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I don't know if I agree with you on this, Nathan, because I bought the same professional level golf clubs as the pros use. And, you know, so there must be something wrong either with the ball or with the tee I'm using. Maybe I'm using left-handed tees. I don't know. I'm right-handed. But anyway, but you make a good point. You make a good point. You try to, you know, force fit these tools. And the real question is not only which tool makes sense, but which tool, how to use the tool in the given situation and in the culture itself. I've seen people come into the companies who brought in past practices that just did, it was a square peg in a round hole. Okay,
Yeah.
relative to the culture, right? So, Nathan, this has been great. Thank you very much for your input on this, and we'll probably be talking more and more about this as we go forward. But it's a very, you know, complicated subject, quite frankly. But I think the way you talk about it, though, you break it down pretty easily and pretty simple. And I think that's making the difficult, the complex, simple, I think, is really what this is all about. So I do appreciate your time on this, and we will wrap it up. This was episode 46 on the Lean 911 podcast. Any questions, you can email me at mark@lean911.com, Mark, M-A-R-K, at lean911.com. And any questions for Nathan, send them on to me, and I'll get them on to Nathan, and we'll go from there. Or you can find him on LinkedIn. That's Nathan Corliss, Corliss, correct?
Correct.
I got it right. I'm not a good speller, so I'm glad I got it right. Nathan, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark. It was a pleasure to
Okay.
be here.
You bet. See you next time.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.